Welcome back to today's Intelligent Medicine Podcast. I'm your host, Dr. Ronald Hoffman. Our subject is pelvic health and pelvic pain. There's a wide variety of disorders that come under the broad rubric of pelvic floor disorders. They afflict both men and women. We laid the groundwork for our discussion in part one, talking specifically about how many men suffering from urinary conditions, from sometimes issues related to bowel function, chronic pain, sexual issues, may be suffering from a pelvic floor disorder. With us today, Stephanie Prendergast. Stephanie is co-author of the book Pelvic Pain Explained. She is one of the foremost experts in the subject. She's the first physical therapist to serve as president of the Pelvic Pain Society. And that's a very, very important new innovation in medicine, is that we're beginning to look at these conditions as at least a contributing factor, pelvic floor dysfunction. So when it comes to women, Stephanie, what are the spectrum of conditions that might be related to this?
So speaking on the pelvic pain end of symptoms for women, they experience similar symptoms to men, urinary urgency, frequency, but then they also can experience provoked pain with insertion or intercourse, or unprovoked pain in the same areas. So they may experience bulbar burning, feeling sharp shooting, stabbing, knife-like pain, feels itchy. It feels like they have a urinary tract infection, or it may feel like they have a yeast infection, except, again, the cultures will return negative. The muscles, tissues, and nerves, when impaired, can create those same symptoms of infections. Of course, it's important to rule them out, but when cultures come back time after time again negative, it's reasonable to suspect that there is a pelvic floor disorder. And they may initially start out as culture-proven infections, but things like, we'll take yeast for example, may sensitize the tissues of a woman's vulva. If you experience 3 to 4 yeast infections in 1 year, the symptoms may be treated and resolved with appropriate medication. However, the symptoms persist. Mm-hmm. So let's say we do eliminate the infection, but now your tissues are sensitized from having yeast in that area repetitively. This makes your muscles tighten in response to that.
So it's not either or. It's not either or. In other words, yes. It could start as an infection or perhaps a bad urinary tract infection or a bad yeast infection, bacterial infection. And then that could sort of, the pain echoes, the nerves are activated, a pain circuit gets created that is hard to extinguish.
That is correct. Yeah, so sometimes for women the etiology could be repetitive infections, but then they now have a musculoskeletal compromise from that, and now, again, there's symptoms that are being generated without the presence of bacteria and or yeast. It's a common mechanism, and because this does affect many more women than men, as we've talked about, we also have hormonal influences in women that men are escape that route a little bit. So in the vulva, the vestibule, the periurethral tissues, these are hormonally sensitive tissues. And so in recent years, the use of oral contraceptives essentially can put a woman into basically a chemical menopause, and with that has come the rise of vulvar pain conditions. So we now know that certain women are susceptible to developing vulvodynia from oral contraceptive use. Similar other end of the spectrum is as women enter perimenopause and menopause, there's less estrogen and testosterone available. These tissues can become compromised and again break down and be painful either only with provoked situations like intercourse, or when severe enough, can be unprovoked, so you're feeling constant burning, stabbing, itching, even without the presence of something like a tampon or penetration.
So hormone replacement or hormone application could be part of rejuvenating the tissue down there, making it less likely that the nerves are unhappy?
That is correct. If the vestibular tissue and other tissues that are hormonally sensitive have been compromised, either through something like menopause, through breastfeeding, oral contraceptives, typically, again, it's a multimodal treatment approach. So the patient may need physical therapy for the musculoskeletal consequences, but that will not regenerate tissue that's hormonally compromised because of insufficiencies. So often then physical therapists will work with a gynecologist or another physician to help with the topical application or possibly systemic hormone supplementation in addition to the physical therapy.
Mm-hmm. What about trauma? Because I've had a couple of patients who said, I have one guy who said ever since he rode down on a water slide, I've got to watch out for those water slides, he has had chronic pelvic pain. And I suggested that he get a workup for some sort of pelvic pain disorder because all the tests are negative. They say that his nerves don't appear to be damaged, but he's in a lot of discomfort. Can falling on your sits bone create a problem sometimes?
Absolutely. So mechanical causes or trauma, whether it be something like a fall on the tailbone, a fall off a horse, a car accident, let's say your knees hit the dashboard, that upsets the hip and the SI joint, your pelvic floor muscles are in the middle. All of those things can also be one mechanism that men and women develop these issues. So there can be hormonal reasons, there can be infectious reasons, there can be mechanical trauma, surgical trauma. Those are kind of the general four categories of how somebody ends up in this situation.
And of course, surgical trauma would be, say a hysterectomy, but there can also be bladder prolapse or uterine prolapse.
Surgical correction of, yes. And I mean, those issues can also commonly cause pelvic pain in mm-hmm. certain cases. But some of the pelvic floor reconstructive procedures have, unfortunately, in the last few years, resulted in an increase in pelvic pain syndrome.
Mm. Okay. Indeed. So, well, let's get to what can be done for these conditions. What is it like? I mean, what's pelvic floor disorder physical therapy like?
So the treatments typically involve at least a one-hour appointment. Just like other types of physical therapy, this may occur over a series of several appointments. It's very rarely just a one-and-done type of thing. During that appointment, I think physical therapists particularly are well-positioned to best help the patients because they can take the history that involves gynecological history, urologic history, colorectal, physical capacity. We need to understand what they can and can't do, how their symptoms started, and then pair that with a physical examination. So it involves a pelvic floor examination, which is either done through the vagina or through the anus, but it also involves looking at the muscles of the pelvic girdle and how the person functions as a whole. Once we take the objective findings based on the patient's history and their symptoms, a physical therapist will develop an assessment, which is basically a little story, if you will, about how this person ended up with the symptoms that they have and which structures are primarily responsible for that. Following that, we develop a treatment plan. So that will involve some sort of physical therapy, which will basically consist of manual therapy to address the impairments identified, but also home exercises so the patient can work on these things themselves. We also will compare our notes with that of their active physicians. Sometimes patients need medication in addition to physical therapy. Sometimes they also need procedures or hormonal supplementation, like what I mentioned. So we, as we get an hour with the patient, is longer than most medical professionals have, can really take it as helping them navigate the rest of the process and helping them organize the treatment plan and their other medical providers. Every 6 to 8 weeks, we will reestablish our goals. We'll see what symptoms are improving, what symptoms aren't, and if we need to redevelop the treatment plan, modify the treatment plan, continue, we will do so. It really depends on the severity and chronicity of a patient's problem. I can't really give an example of exactly how long physical therapy takes, but mm-hmm. typically it's at least 8 one-week visits in best-case scenarios for pelvic pain.
And what does it involve? Does it involve some form of touch therapy, massage, pressure? You manually address this with the patient.
Right. Of course, physical therapists would cringe at the word massage because I know everybody thinks we're a little more sophisticated, but that's the most, it's the most basic thing that people can relate it to.
Yeah.
It's specific manual techniques to address tissue dysfunction, muscle dysfunction, joint dysfunction, as well as helping the patient basically learn how to move again in a way that is appropriate. Mm-hmm. We don't mean gross movements like, they look abnormal, but to us they actually do.
Right.
And so we want to help them retrain their muscles so this doesn't happen again.
Okay, because, you know, and I'm speaking from gross ignorance on this subject. You know, I used to think, okay, the way you treat it is just to teach patients, you know, to do some Kegel exercises, like learn how to squeeze your pelvic muscles, you know, stop and start your urinary stream. That's one way. If you don't know how to access your pelvic muscles, that's one way to explain that to patients. But earlier you alluded to the fact that that's kind of precisely the opposite of what you want to tell patients to do in terms of homework.
That's correct. So if a person has a low tone pelvic floor disorder, which we have not really discussed, if they're older and they have incontinence, perhaps a Kegel exercise regime is appropriate in some cases. Younger patients do not need to Kegel, and that is not indicated for pelvic pain. They don't have pain because they're weak. They have pain because their nerves are irritated and their muscles are too tight. So the opposite is actually warranted. We teach them what's called a reverse Kegel or a pelvic floor drop, which is basically to help their muscles return to normal length. Weak muscles do not cause pain. Weak muscles can lead to injury, and then that can lead to tightness and tenderness and pain. But it's actually opposite of what many people think, but that's all we know. Many people have heard of the Kegels, and they think of strengthening, but this is actually the opposite end of the spectrum.
Okay. And when you mentioned, you know, medical therapies, often when doctors are confronted with these patients who just complain endlessly of problems where there doesn't seem to be a physical correlate, you know, nobody can find anything, they say this condition is all in your head. Is there a, but certainly there may be some truth to the fact that there's a, the chronicity of this sets up depression or sets up hypersensitivity to pain, the circuits amplified, and things get progressively worse.
So you're touching on a few different things. When people experience persisting pain conditions, of course there can be associated depression and anxiety. But also, as we know now, as pain science has evolved, there is the hypersensitivity that you mentioned. So if there is a persisting pain issue that maybe started out as a muscle or tissue or nerve issue, all of a sudden that patient's threshold throughout their body is going to be lower. Things that should not cause pain, like sitting, start to cause pain. And their nervous system responds in a way that everything is a pain stimuli when in fact it's not. And there's top-down therapies to address both the psychological consequences from persistent pain, but also the central nervous system hypersensitivity that comes. And they're separate, and they're definitely not crazy. It's not in their heads, and I feel like it's unfortunate that it gets told that if people just didn't know what was wrong with them. But there are psychological and central nervous system considerations that need to be factored into treatment plans if there is a sensitized patient. Some of the manual techniques that I mentioned may not be appropriate for someone if they have had uncontrolled and persisting pain for years. They may need to get on appropriate medication first and have appropriate interventional procedures before physical therapy is something that can help them. So it's the role of the PT to be able to assess who those patients are and help them get to the place that they need if PT is not yet appropriate.
And some of the medications that may be invoked here are medications that are sometimes used for fibromyalgia, another chronic pain syndrome, like Neurontin or Lyrica or amitriptyline. These are some medications that may break the cycle, you know, while the therapist addresses the underlying cause.
Correct. There's three classes of drugs that are typically appropriate. Those are the SNRIs, the tricyclic antidepressants, and the neuromodulators. And we're not suggesting that a patient takes an antidepressant because they're depressed, even though they may be. It's just that those are the classes of drugs that are actually therapeutic for this type of neuropathic pain. And so there's a lot of misconceptions around the medications and how to use them, and we try to debunk those myths as well.
It's been suggested for some of these patients that they get Botox injections because that relaxes spasm. Has that been a useful technique in your experience?
Absolutely, especially for the patients that we see coming from places like Mexico where there isn't pelvic floor physical therapy.
Oh, okay.
If an identified muscle spasm, if we know a muscle is hypertonic and we are pretty certain it's contributing to their pain, Botox injections specifically into those muscles may be an appropriate part of their treatment plan. We can get around it without it, but sometimes it's nice knowing it's there in the cases that we're really having a hard time having them maintain the gains in physical therapy. I like knowing it's available.
Indeed. So in your book, Pelvic Pain Explained, are there self-administered questionnaires that can help patients identify whether they're a candidate for this evaluation?
We don't have questionnaires necessarily, but if they experience the type of symptoms, urinary urgency, frequency, burning, symptoms that feel like a yeast infection or a UTI, genital pain, pain with orgasm, inability to orgasm, these are all indicators that there could be a pelvic floor problem, and that warrants at least the first step to an evaluation.
Mm-hmm. And so, you know, you obviously you're one of the founders of the very society that gets the word out about this and has meetings and addresses this. The U.S. has a population over 300 million, probably at least 150 million adults. How many qualified pelvic floor disorder therapists are there in the country? Probably the ratio is not very inspiring.
Yes. Off the top of my head, I'm not quite sure of the statistics, but it's in most states now, compared to I began doing this type of work in 2001, in almost every state in the United States, we can find qualified people that are trained to treat these types of disorders from a physical therapy perspective. And many physicians, if they can treat pain, they don't necessarily need to know specifics of pelvic pain. Pain is pain, no matter where it is in the body. So a lot of times our people dealing with these issues want to find an expert specifically in pelvic pain, and they may overlook a resource in their area that could still be helpful from a pain management perspective. And that's important to remember, too.
Well, you're co-founder of the Pelvic Health and Rehabilitation Center. They have offices in San Francisco, Berkeley, Los Gatos, Los Angeles, and Boston, so predominantly on the West Coast. But there's one East Coast outpost in Boston. Do you frequently get patients who come from afar and then they get properly evaluated and then you maybe can farm them out to somebody locally after the proper initial diagnosis has been made?
Correct. And again, I feel like that used to be more common than it is now, because sometimes if we do an initial phone consult with somebody, we may be able to quickly pair them with someone that we have some connection with, whether it's through the International Pelvic Pain Society or the courses. We can likely pair them with someone in their area who can actually help them. It's just a matter of who they find first. So we try to minimize the out-of-town visits, but in some cases, as I mentioned, Mexico and some other countries, there's just not resources yet available.
Mm-hmm.
But the United States is looking better. So we try to get people into someone in their neighborhood who can help, because these problems take a while to treat. It's not something that goes away with one treatment or one medication or one injection. So it's best to create a local team.
And what does the training consist of for a pelvic floor dysfunction physical therapist? A weekend seminar? I kind of doubt it, right?
Well, some people may take a lot of physical therapists who are treating these disorders have sought out postgraduate education on their own. And so that may come in the form of several weekend courses. It may be through a year-long mentorship program. There's a few different programs available through the American Physical Therapy Association and some other private mentoring. But the physical therapists are really dedicated to doing this type of work, seek out the information, and have to often pay a lot of money out of their own pocket to get these types of training. And again, it's not really standardized yet at this period of time, so there is a variety of experience amongst therapists.
Right. And I was going to ask one other thing, which is, what about biofeedback? Because, we've heard about biofeedback for, various conditions. There's a unique type of biofeedback that's sometimes used for this, correct?
It used to be used more frequently with women who had lower tone pelvic floor disorders, mm-hmm. who had difficulty doing a Kegel exercise to teach them how to do that.
It gave them feedback that they were doing it correctly.
Correct. And now it can be used both for up training, which would be a Kegel exercise, but also it could be used to teach people how to relax their pelvic floors,
mm-hmm.
too. That can also be done manually. A physical therapist can do that without biofeedback equipment, just by using their finger and working on motor control with a patient.
Okay, so you don't need a gadget, because, ignorance is I thought that this was all the rage, is that, you know, some device that you would attach to your pelvic muscles or insert vaginally or rectally, and the pressure would give you some feedback as to whether you were doing it right, you know, whatever maneuvers you were suggested to do.
And that was appropriate before physical therapists. Nurses used to do that mostly in physicians' offices before physical therapists really became involved in the field. And as the involvement of physical therapists have come into play, then they tend to do things manually with their hands because they're trained. In our offices, we don't use biofeedback, but I know some people do. I find it's expensive and it's a lot of tedious work for the patient when we can just do the same thing manually.
Oh, great. Okay, so let's give out some resources. First of all, your book is a great introduction to the subject, Pelvic Pain Explained, get it from the usual sources. The author, our guest, Stephanie Prendergast, P-R-E-N-D-E-R-G-A-S-T. Easily confused with Pendergast, but it's P-R-E. And then what about the society that certifies qualifies physical therapists to do this work? Where do they have a website?
Yes. The American Physical Therapy Association has a division called, unfortunately, the Women's Health Division of the American Physical Therapy Association. So even though it says women's health, it's obviously now recognized that men have this disorder too. They're working on the nomenclature. But right now, for people to find, men or women, to find a physical therapist, that's one resource that they can do. They can do find a provider, and that website will direct them to people in their area that have some sort of training in this type of work. The International Pelvic Pain Society is a good place to find psychologists, physicians, and physical therapists. So if you're looking for a medical provider that has some experience with this, or even contacting the people through the International Pelvic Pain Society, they, again, similar to us, may be able to direct somebody to somebody in their area that maybe isn't listed yet on the website. And so it's worth it to make a few phone calls or send emails to try to, again, create a local team for yourself.
Indeed. And what
those
is your
top two resources?
Yeah. And what is your website again, please?
Our website is pelvicpainrehab.com. And we have a find a provider section on our blog, which is a section of our website.
Well, great. Anything that is important that we haven't covered that you want to impart to our audience?
I just think it's important to know that they can and will get better. It just may not be initially an easy process. But once they find the right people, it's important to know that these disorders are very treatable.
Well, that's a great message to get out. And, hope that this podcast provides people who feel like they've got a dead end with an option to get better. That's what this program's all about. And I'm sure that's what your work is all about. Thank you very much, Stephanie Prendergast, for joining us. The book is Pelvic Pain Explained. I'm Dr. Ronald Hoffman, and this is the Intelligent Medicine Podcast.